Food is fuel for your body, your mind, and definitely your sport. But let's face it, nutrition is confusing, and the expectations on girls and women to be thin and have a six-pack are exhausting. If you've ever been frustrated with your body, confused about nutrition, obsessed with eating healthy, or guilty when you don't, underate, overate, or overtrained, and overwhelmed with all the pressure, then this podcast is for you. Nutrition can be easy. You can take control of it, but it might start with letting go of control by asking for help and making a change. I'm Lindsay Elizabeth Cortez, sports dietitian and owner of Rise Up Nutrition, where I empower female athletes to overcome nutrition concerns and perform at their highest level, to stop being confused by all the mixed or harmful messages, and finally have confidence in your body as a fierce, fit, and fueled female athlete. Hey fans, Lindsay Elizabeth Cortez, your host of the podcast, sports dietitian, mother, runner, lifelong athlete, entrepreneur, podcast host. Okay, enough about me. I'm here with an amazing guest today, a fellow sports dietitian, Kelsey Pontius. I am so excited for this conversation because with many of my guests, I like research their background and I come up with questions for them. And with Kelsey, she's a fellow sports dietitian. So I was like, what do you want to talk about? And she was like, you know, we could talk about, she listed a variety of things, but she said, you know, low carb availability. And also I've been using a continuous glucose monitor and we could talk about that. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is perfect. I recently talked about low carb availability among my clients that I still have in the alumni program as it relates to low energy availability. And so I felt like, yes, this is something to share on the podcast. And further, I've been using a continuous glucose monitor for my son who has a rare genetic metabolic disorder called glycogen storage disease type 1A. It's very rare, but I've had a lot of hands-on experience with continuous glucose monitors and glucose levels. And I felt that this was something I wanted to talk about on the podcast, about blood sugar and glucose and monitors, but I didn't feel fully comfortable doing it on a solo episode just yet. But now my experience combined with Kelsey's experience as a dietitian and an athlete, I was like, this is the ideal time for this conversation. So I think it's a kind of science-y focused episode, which is great, but coming from two sports dietitians with tons of practical and hands-on application as well. As we go into this episode, we're going to talk about blood sugar and blood glucose, and I'm actually going to warn you of overinterpreting and overanalyzing the data too much on your own. However, that is one reason I absolutely love Inside Tracker, because it is a way for you to get your blood biomarkers tested, and you can then have tons of information at your fingertips on their platform to help you interpret that data. You can also connect with a registered dietitian directly on their site, or maybe you already have your own dietitian that you can talk through this information. I feel like so often when we go to our doctors and ask for blood work, they're not understanding it from the nutrition and athletic perspective in depth that you might want from them. They're going to look at it clinically to say this is within range or out of range, and that's important, but might not be all the information that you're looking for as an athlete. And that's why I like Inside Tracker, because you can get your blood work and then you can coordinate with a dietitian to understand, interpret it, and know if any changes are needed and what those changes might be. So if you head to insidetracker.com, you can use the code LindsayCPro25. That's Lindsay, LindsayC, for Cortez, Pro, PRO, 25 for 25% off any of your Inside Tracker orders. And that's one way that you can look at blood biomarkers and learn a little bit more about your body, which is what Kelsey and I are going to get into, the importance of learning about blood sugar in your body. And actually, we're also going to get into trusting your body even without the data. So without further ado, Kelsey. Kelsey Pontius is a registered dietitian and owner of Meteor Nutrition. Meteor Nutrition arose after lifelong athlete Kelsey wished to pursue her passion for the impact of nutrition on the human body. Kelsey grew up playing competitive soccer and eventually ended her career as a D1 soccer player to transform into a distance runner who has since qualified for both the 2020 and 2024 U.S. Olympic marathon trials. Through several instances of her athletic background, she felt the ebbs and flows with nutrition on performance. She knew she was destined to help other athletes benefit from the implementation of optimal nutrition. Aside from working with ambitious athletes, Kelsey has worked in the clinical arena with a multitude of different medical complexities. Having a variety of different experiences in dietetics has given Kelsey the necessary tools to allow wholesome food to heal and fuel the remarkable human body. Thank you. Thank you for being willing to chat today.
Yes, thanks for having me. Like I've been saying, I have been a fan of your podcast and following you for a really long time. And so, yeah, I've listened to many female athlete nutrition podcast episodes. So I'm excited about this.
Well, thank you. I was excited to hear that because when we connected on Instagram, you know, I've been following you as a dietitian as well as a runner, which I think is what, you know, gives you so much street cred, I guess I'll just say, you know, like it's for both. And the fact that they overlap, that you are a highly competitive athlete and a super experienced and knowledgeable sports dietitian. I've been following you and kind of a fan of your running and a supporter of your work. And so when we connected, it was really nice to know that you were also, you know, a follower and a listener of the podcast for me. And so it's interesting too, because every once in a while when I have other dietitians on, I'm always like, what are we going to talk about? Because like, no offense or anything, but I'm like, I already know what you know type of thing. And yeah. So when I asked you, like, what do you want to talk about? And you gave me a couple topic suggestions. You reignited my like excitement over, and I actually did research. I was like, I'm going to pull up some articles and like, I'm super excited to connect with you on this. I feel, correct me if I, because I don't know you that well, but I feel like you're a data person. Do you like reading the science and the data when it comes to nutrition?
I do, but I have to tread lightly because I know about myself that I can get super fixated on data to a fault. And that's like my natural personality.
Yeah.
And so, for example, like I've worked with sleep specialists. That's kind of my hurdle as an athlete in the past. And like right now I have one that's making me wear a Whoop. And I'm like, I have to tread lightly with this Whoop. Like it's just a little bit TMI for like, as far as like being overstimulated. And so I love it, but I almost, for my own personal life, have to tread lightly. So I appreciate when my clients are kind of the same thing with needing a boundary.
I think I can say that for myself, and I've heard that from a lot of other dietitians too. Sometimes what draws us into the field of like sports science and nutrition is actually a love of data, a love of numbers, a love of science. But then as we get into it, like the practical application, we have to step away from that, put some boundaries up for our own success. And that's what I've found in my clients too. Like, I'm always like, okay, I'll interpret the data, but you like don't do anything with it because I need you to focus on behaviors or like just actual implication, like doing the actions and not focusing too much on the data. It can hold us back in some ways. And I think we'll get into that later on in our conversation. But before we go too much further, I'd love to give you a moment to just have you share a little bit about your work as a sports dietitian. You are running your own business and helping athletes. Just share a little bit more about kind of your mission statement and what type of people you help and how.
Yeah, so a lot like other sports dietitians, I've been a lifelong athlete, and I actually started as a soccer player. And so I grew up playing competitive soccer and ended up playing in college. And unfortunately, my sophomore year, I had concussions. And so just playing collegiately, ironically, my husband now is an athletic trainer, and we talk a lot about how my concussion was managed. And this was circa, I'm aging myself, but 2010, where it's a little bit different now.
Yeah.
But, you know, in his expertise says it wasn't managed appropriately. And I just remember I had multiple of them my sophomore year. And so I just felt like I was in this hole and couldn't get out of this like cycle of concussions and playing. And so I ended up leaving the university and leaving soccer entirely. And that's when I started studying nutrition and dietetics, because it really wasn't in choice that I chose that major. I was kinesiology. And when I transferred to the new school, exercise science was like a limited access that you could only get into in the fall. And I didn't want to get behind even more. And so I'm like, okay, nutrition and dietetics, they're accepting students right away. And so I've always been curious about dietetics. So I liked it. But fast forward, I started running. And so my timeline of becoming a runner and studying dietetics was simultaneous almost. And so I just kind of, you know, as a soccer player, I grew up with a really healthy relationship with food. And as soon as I started becoming a runner, I was like, this is different. And so that interest, like, I think that in so many ways, for better or for worse, like, I became really interested in dietetics. And so after I finished my degree in training in dietetics, I started working in a clinical job. And then I actually started working for another private practice underneath another local sports dietitian. And she was so busy that she's a great sports dietitian, but she was so busy that I just didn't get the learning from her that I thought I was going to get. And so I started my own practice. My sister's a business owner, and she was just like, why don't you do this yourself?
Yeah.
And so I started Meteor, and, you know, I didn't turn back. I eventually decreased my hours in the hospital, and then I started getting more and more clients, and I started getting to a point where I'm like, I would pay the amount of money I'm making at the hospital to not have to go on a Saturday. And my husband now was like, I think that's a good sign that you're ready to be 2 feet in with your business. And so since then, I've been working predominantly with athletes. I think where I'm from, Jacksonville, it's by landmass, it's the biggest city in the United States. And so it's, you know, not a ton of people, but it's a large landmass of population. And so
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I think because I was born and raised here, a lot of times I'm kind of the nutrition professional that, you know, I'm the only one someone knows to go to. So sometimes I see other things other than sports, and it's kind of refreshing sometimes. But
yeah,
predominantly athletes since then. And I see all kinds of sports. I have a lot of endurance because being an endurance athlete, but I do see like the occasional, I love working with soccer players. Obviously, I'm a little bit biased.
Yeah.
And then I work with, in the college setting too, I do contract work with a few different universities. And then I work with a professional track team right now too.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think that diversity is good. I've, since running my own business, I started being diverse, taking all clients, and then I niched down, and then I like niched down, but built out other contracts with bigger, you know, companies or universities. And that was good. And things are changing for me now too. But sometimes I love niching down because you're the expert, but then also you need something different just for something different, like something fun, refreshing, a challenge, or just to like, I think also every once in a while, some of our hardest clients are, you know, even if they're niched down to being an endurance athlete in your case, or for me, like just a female athlete, maybe that disordered eating spectrum, like not everybody fits that mold perfectly. Maybe it's an endurance athlete with diabetes. And so your clinical skills of, oh, I've had diabetes patients before, like helps, you know, so you need that diversity. And I think that's awesome. I love that your sister is a business owner. I love that you went all in, and hoping that you continue to find great success, because I think you're doing really impactful work. I've seen your client testimonials and things like that too. So that's awesome. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about your running journey as well. So obviously you were a great soccer player. Concussion kind of ended that. So did you pick up running just like knowing that you'd be great at it, thinking you could pursue it at a high level, or just something else to do after soccer ended?
Yeah, I literally like ran right into running. And so after I stopped playing soccer, I remember I walked into a Lululemon Athletica, and I just thought, I felt a lot of energy in there. And I walked in there, I was a college student, couldn't afford anything in the store, but I felt a lot of energy in there. And so I just left a team. And since I was 3 years old, I've always had a built-in team playing competitive soccer. And so like, that when I transferred was, even though I was moving back to Jacksonville where I was born and raised, I felt like I moved back and didn't have a community. And so I applied for a job at Lululemon Athletica, and I got it. And the way that it was set up then, I don't know if it's still this way, but they were very community driven in terms of getting us into different kinds of classes, getting us to races and stuff like that. And so one of my coworkers, and we're still really great friends now, invited me to do a 50K.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. And I'm the queen of like saying yes and then like asking details later. And so I said yes without thinking about how many miles that was, and that I've never ran a race before or never trained.
Yeah.
And so long story short, we still laugh about it because my first race ever was a 50K, but and the training of it is laughable. I didn't follow any kind of structure or anything.
But you were a lifetime athlete, so it's not like you were, you know, completely unprepared, but you certainly weren't trained for it per se. But Yeah.
Specifically. I mean, yeah. I was center midfielder too. So like in a 90-minute game, like you're running 6-7 miles, you know, and then if the game goes into overtime, then plus.
Yeah.
So I had so much fun. I found that like I really liked the community behind running. I really liked finding kind of that competitive energy again. And I think I ended up doing local races for like a year after that. And then people were like, okay, you need a coach. And I really do. I think you'll appreciate this, Lindsay. I didn't get hurt. Like, I've only had one injury in like 10, 11 years of running. And I really do think it came from like a soccer background of contact sports, like never really going through what a lot of runners go through. And so I was really fortunate in that regard. So I got a coach, got some structured training. He gave me some other opportunities and experiences of like signing up for track races, getting me more experience, and kind of threw me into the fire before I was ready to, but catching me up on experience. Yeah. And I'm really grateful that we did that, because then, you know, fast forward, have gotten the opportunity to compete in two Olympic trials now.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. And I know the most, obviously we just had, was it a month ago, the Olympic marathon Olympic trials a month ago. So now that you've done two of those, have you had any, hopefully I'm not pressuring you too soon, but had any thoughts about like, are you going to continue training at this level? I mean, because that's a lot of training, and that's every 4 years. So it's, you know, been about 8 years of very high level training. Have you had any thoughts about moving forward? Are you going to keep pursuing it, or we're just giving it a little time?
Yeah, I think that like the nature of women's running right now, like women are doing incredible things like well into their 40s. And so I think I just have this curiosity of what my body can do for like the next 4-8 years. And so right now I actually, after the trials, like dug deep into thinking about what's like the best thing to preserve my relationship with running. And I am taking less structure for this very season and doing things in my local community that sounds fun instead of, you know, such structure.
Yeah.
We're preparing for the Olympic trials. But I think that, you know, I do want to run in the, I guess it would be the 2028 ones eventually. So I do need a little break from that much structure, but we'll see. But, you know, any direction, I'm not sold.
Yeah, I love that. My parents were just here this weekend. My dad's a lifelong runner, and him and I went out for a jog, and we were talking about that because I'm in a phase of my life of I have two young children and pregnancies and craziness going on that I'm like, and I'm running right now. Things have changed in my life, and I've actually been able to get like 4 solid runs in a week, and I just like feel so good, but I'm not able to like race yet. My lifestyle isn't set up for that. But my dad and I were just talking about like the Olympic trials and how just the women in the running community today are proving you can do this in your 40s, you can do this in your 30s, you can be high level, you can be fast, you can break PRs, you can have children and keep doing it. And I'm just like, yeah, like I might not be racing right now and I'm never going to go to the Olympic trials like you, but I'm still excited about that future. It's so empowering. So you can absolutely take a pause and know that you can still explore where this will lead for you in your future. I love that.
Yes, my favorite. I didn't have a great Olympic trials day, as you know, but my favorite highlight of that day is they really celebrated the women in the field before we got to the start line. Yeah. And it was just a really special moment because they talked about how we were the most diverse field. We are also the most competitive field. But they mentioned how many moms were in the field, and they mentioned some of the like careers and like other details about the women in the field. And I've never been so excited to start a race. And then Joan Bonoa like started us.
Yeah.
So I was so fired up. And no, it was just really cool to like be on a start line with mothers and women that are doing so many other things beyond just running.
Working full time and running at that level.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And so it was just made me really proud to like be among women. Yeah.
Girl power moment for sure. No, I got this. Yes. I just... the 2020 and 2024 Olympic trials marathon race, the Olympics as well, but like the actual trials has been because you see, you know, there's one thing about seeing the elites, and then there's that like, is it appropriate to call it sub-elite category?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I would definitely.
Yeah. It's like that sub-elite category is almost more fascinating to me. of like.
And just like a couple minutes, like yes, just a, anything minutes. Could happen on any day mm-hmm. to like a couple minutes. But like all of a sudden this nurse that works yeah. 60 hours a week exactly. is running 2 minutes within a full-time contract athlete.
Exactly. That's what's like mind-blowing to me and so inspiring. So, and that's you. You're in that category and you're doing that. You're working full-time. You're running a business. You know, you're married and you're also running at this super high level. So it's so impressive and just wishing the best for you moving forward. But this obviously also like brings you a lot of experience that you can bring to your clients and your journey with running, your journey with nutrition. And one thing that when I started this episode saying I asked you what you want to talk about and you said, well, we could talk about like low carbohydrate availability in athletes and we're going to segue carbohydrate intake as well into like blood glucose and things like that. So I'm super excited because in, was it September 2023? So just what is that, 6 months-ish ago? Was when there was an updated REDS consensus statement. So the term REDS, relative energy deficiency in sport, was kind of coined in 2014. We've had since then a couple updates that are published. But 2023, the newest consensus statement, added a bit more research and some different terminology in how we talk about REDS. Because now it's like, ooh, you know, we had a bunch of research up until 2014, then we coined the term, and now we've had a lot of research in the past, oh my gosh, is that 10 years? Holy moly. Okay, we've had 10 years of research, and I still feel like there's not enough research, especially in the female athlete population, and that's, you know, something that consensus said is we still need more research, but there were a couple things that were highlighted in there that were different in the 10 years of research, and one of a huge takeaway was that low carbohydrate availability may be impacting the symptoms of REDS and negative health outcomes for life and performance, even independent of energy intake. And I was really glad that the consensus statement brought this up because I feel like I've seen that in my practice and working with clients. I would work with clients who are like, we're eating a lot, we're eating enough. And I'm like, but you just need more carbs, you know? And that really is what would help them kick some of their REDS symptoms and really help them get out of that hole that they had dug themselves is really increasing the carbs. I'd love to hear kind of your perspective when you read through that consensus and learned about the term low carbohydrate availability. Is that something you had picked up on in your practice as well or found the importance of?
Yes. And I think I was picking it up kind of like you in terms of some of the trendier diets with fat adapting and other types of fasting and still seeing these REDS-like symptoms in clients that otherwise throughout the day, maybe they are backloading their days or whatever. And so, but they just weren't eating enough carbohydrates or, you know, when you get the questions like, do I really eat the whole banana or is a bagel okay to eat? Like those kinds of questions and like going off of some of the other guidelines that like other bodies like the IOC and everything that we learn when we, you know, get specialized in sports, some of those metrics, they're still not eating enough of carbohydrates and they're always shocked how much they need, right? And so they might have some of these REDS symptoms or maybe just a few of them. But I think some of these trendier diets kind of diminish what the recommendations actually were and kind of made this whole, you know, perspective of what's a lot of carbohydrates, right?
Yeah.
And so, yes, definitely something that I have been seeing. And then also before kind of this low carbohydrate availability that's kind of coined as LCA, similar to low energy availability and LEA, I think that it really helped me as a practitioner gain confidence in my clinical judgment of that's what was going on with somebody.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. Yeah. I feel like for me too, I had been saying to my clients for years, like, you just need more carbs. You just need more carbs. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I just sound like you're just traditional sports dietitians. That's all carb, carb, carb. But now it's like, okay, we have this published now. We have research to back it. We have a term that we can call it now, low carb availability. And going back to kind of, well, what is the amount of carbohydrate that we need? And I pulled this from, I think the article you sent me. Considerations of low carb availability to relative energy deficiency in sport in female endurance athletes, a narrative review, copy published in 2023. So I just pulled some stats that I want to share with our listeners from that. When we think about, well, what is enough carbohydrate? It's a huge range. It's individually based. It's based on your sport. It's based on your intensity and duration. But going off of body weight, typical recommendations can be anywhere between 5 to 12 grams of carbohydrate per kilogram of your body weight per day. This might take up about 55 to 75% of your diet could be carbohydrate, leaving the remainder for proteins and fats. And some stats that I pulled from the article you sent me, some studies showing female soccer players only 50% consumed more than 5 grams per kilogram, so meaning 50% are consuming less than the recommended range I just mentioned. 85% of female college distance runners were consuming less than the recommended range, averaging 4.7 grams per kilogram, which is less than that recommended range. That's 85%. And then even Australian football players, 30% were at risk of low energy availability, and only 3.7% were consuming adequate carbohydrate. So this is wildly showing us, regardless of energy availability, just athletes, female athletes, don't seem to be consuming enough carbohydrate at all based on our recommendations as sports dietitians.
Yes, I had the same reaction as you, Lindsay, in terms of like seeing the variety of sports that this encompassed with that, because a lot of times, I don't know, I think that in research, runners are a little bit easier to study maybe because there's like a start and stop, but these intermittent sports are like, I think, a little bit more tricky to study. Yes. So I was like, when I got to that part, I was like, wow, this isn't just endurance runners. They've been able to like quantify this in other sports too.
Yeah, I like seeing that too. I agree with you. I think running is, frankly, easy, easy to study. You start, you stop. There's a certain time, you know, you can literally run around a track and yeah, it's just difficult to study other sports. And then I think also that association between low energy availability and low carb availability, well, obviously we can see, well, if you're not eating enough carbs, then you might not be eating enough energy. So it can happen at the same time. You can have low carb availability and low energy availability, but you could also be eating enough energy and not enough carbohydrate. And that's the area that we still need more research on. But we do have a little bit of research there, but we'd still need more on that area. And I actually just had a long-term client that I had a meeting with last week, and she's done amazing. She really actually did have a diagnosed eating disorder. And so she's made leaps and bounds from that. And then it was like, okay, now we can, the mental psychological aspects, like we're greatly improved, but like this is Red's. And now we're even further from that. I'm like, she actually is eating enough energy, but her carbohydrates are still low. And so I was able to, you know, use this terminology with her of it's low carbohydrate availability. But yeah, most low energy availability studies also showed a low carb availability of 25 to 60% reduction. So that's just, I just wanted our listeners to hear these percentages and facts. It's not necessarily a question for you, just like a wow factor, right?
Absolutely.
So I'd love to hear from your perspective too in science and reading through these studies or just in your work as a dietitian. What are some of the negative impacts of low carb availability, even independent of energy availability that you've seen?
Yeah. So, and this is kind of where the paper, kind of that model of what systems, performance consequences, and physiological consequences of low energy availability, they were saying that like really similar in the paper, like the overlap between like the performance decrements, more specifically of impaired performance, impaired recovery. This is more physical, but bone stress injuries and things like that. I would say that I see it kind of with in more application to practice in the recovery element of it. I see a lot of low ferritin, which the paper like later, like towards the bottom of the paper, talks more about iron and ferritin. And
yeah,
in the paper, it's interesting because they said that like, it hasn't been proven that there's a relationship. They kind of assume that the relationship between low carbohydrate availability and iron deficiency is more related to like not enough, not eating foods that contain iron. But for me, like, I think it's super obvious that there's a relationship because if you're not eating enough carbohydrates, then your body is going to be more inflamed from like lack of recovery, lack of energy. Now we're breaking down muscle storages as energy. And we know that when our body's more stressed and more inflamed, we're not absorbing as much iron, regardless of how much we're intaking. Yeah. And so I see a lot of like iron issues. And then that, you know, athlete is doing everything they can to consume simply just more iron, whether it come from supplements or animal sources of iron. But like that still, and then they see no success with their iron storages. And it's, I think it simply can be related to not eating enough carbohydrates, which, you know, carbohydrate metabolism is like the most basic form of metabolism that there is that's going to support like iron metabolism too.
Yeah. And I agree. We have tons of research to show that high hepcidin levels decrease iron absorption. Why do we have high hepcidin? Because of high inflammation. Why do we have high inflammation? Because of low carbohydrate intake, poor recovery. So I absolutely agree. I've seen this in practice, and I'm seeing, you know, those little droplets in research that we can connect the dots. Maybe we don't have a super amazing study to say low carb availability increases iron deficiency, like super correlated, or is that the word correlated? We don't have like that strong highlighted line connecting the two, but we've got lots of information where we can kind of piece the puzzle pieces together. And I see it in practice as well. These athletes that just continually have low iron and they're doing all the iron things, but they still have low carb intake. And so focusing on that, I think, is huge. And then, yeah, the bone information, quite interesting too, because it's like, okay, I don't want to be in low energy availability, so I'm going to eat enough energy. And I'm really going to focus on calcium and vitamin D through my supplements or through dairy or eating my greens. But once again, we have some now research showing that low carbohydrate availability is not only increasing bone breakdown, but it's decreasing bone formation as well. Now, the studies referenced in the consensus statement are all on male athletes, correct? That's what I found. Did you find any with bone and female athletes and low carb availability?
The only thing that I found is that carbohydrates help modulate progesterone and estrogen levels.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of the thought of the connection where with men, maybe, I mean, I guess that with low carbohydrate availability, arguably it could have a role in testosterone that we know is supportive of bone health. But for women, I think that they were connecting the like bone stress injuries and compromises to bone density to that carbs support progesterone and estrogen levels specifically, and that there is this role with like estrogen and then gluconeogenesis, which is just for our listeners, deriving carbohydrate sources from non-carbohydrate foods. And so just a huge component of carbohydrate metabolism. And so obviously for females in a quote unquote normal cycle, those estrogen levels are going to change, and estrogen is so supportive of bone throughout the cycle, and that's normal. But if you don't have enough carbs, then estrogen isn't going to cooperate like it would in a healthy body. And so therefore, the metabolism of our carbs in our body is going to be altered.
Yeah, great point. And at the end of the day, you know, we don't want low carb availability in male or female. It's just also that it's that emerging like, oh, are there differences because of this as well? It's something that we want to pay attention to as we look into every research, is which sex population is this done on so that we can better apply it to ourselves. And that's a really interesting point, is carbs effect on estrogen and therefore its effects on bone health as well. So yeah, and the gluconeogenesis as well, the ability for the body to create glucose, affecting that whole pathway too. So this is just, I think, more fuel for the fire for us as sports dietitians and then all of our listeners to, if you're dealing with reds, understand that it's also equally important not just to get your energy up, but to get your carbohydrates up. And that you might feel like you don't resonate with reds because you are eating enough, but still be not optimizing carbs. And in our society, so many people say, well, I am eating carbs. Well, I do eat carbs. But for performance, you might be shocked as how much is actually optimal for athletes. I'd love to know, in your journey, you've been an athlete your whole life, Kelsey, but shifting from soccer, which actually is, like you said, you could run 6 to 7 miles in a game. That is extremely aerobic. You're burning a lot of carbohydrates. But shifting from that into marathon running, which is, you know, more of that traditionally considered an endurance sport compared to soccer, have you found like that shift when you think about to maybe 10 years ago versus now, like a higher carbohydrate diet or really having to put more focus on it on a personal level?
Yes, I've actually seen a positive correlation big time. Like with getting to new levels of running, you get access to things like your personal fluids on the course. Mm-hmm. And so I really saw some of my like performance change when I had access to more carbohydrates, which I thought was really telling for me. And just kind of marrying that application to practice. I don't know if you've, I'm sure you have had those moments where you're like thinking about stuff that we learn and then you're marrying and you're like, this is so cool.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, to your point, coming from a soccer background, you know, we just didn't have the access that soccer players and any kind of, I didn't know what a sports dietitian was even when I was in college and I went to a Division I school. So I wasn't thinking too much about it. But when I shifted to running, the paleo diet was like super hot then. Mm. And so I was actually in a relationship where the person I was with was doing the paleo diet. Mm-hmm. And I was like starting my nutrition degree. And so I was actually starting to eat more in that framework. And I just remember not feeling great at that point. I was in my early 20s. So I had a more resilient body than I do now for sure.
Yeah.
But my coach along the way, he was ahead of the curve. He's been around running and around female athletes and everything. And he said in his experience, he doesn't like to stereotype, but in his experience, female athletes sometimes, you know, hold back with eating enough carbohydrates. And I remember I wouldn't do sports drinks at the time and he didn't coach me in person, but I remember he was on a trip out to Florida and just being with him and was really, really a eye-opening experience because at this part of my education, I was more learning nutrition through the lens of health than performance. I was at the very beginning of my studies.
Yeah.
And so I had no idea. And so that was really, really helpful. And then he's been my coach all along. So he's offered me along the way, just like really encouraging things that like helped me marry what I was learning with a positive relationship with food. Like he says things like, I would rather you get on the starting line just really well fueled than worry about like, you know, the carbohydrate, what's going to happen to your body after you carbohydrate load. And so that's been really helpful to have a really supportive coach. And I think that's why we have worked so well together over the last 10 years because he really helped. And then I started seeing better recovery and better outcomes the more that I married what I was learning through the lens of sports nutrition with my training.
Yeah. And I love how you mentioned like in our journey as dietitians, sometimes we learn something, but then we have that aha moment applying it to our life. And on this topic of really increasing carbohydrate, I've actually found breaking past, like if here's a great example, because it happened to me just like 2 years ago. And again, I've been pregnant and having babies the past 2 years. So like my experiences, personal experience with sports nutrition are a little more limited. But in one of those periods, I was starting to build up my training again. And then we actually had Pop-Tarts in the house. I was like, I'm going to have Pop-Tarts just before my run. And in my head, my sports nutrition mind went like 30 to 60 grams of carbohydrate pre-run. And a package of Pop-Tarts actually has more than that. And my brain went, maybe you don't need all this. But then I started eating and I was like, well, I'm hungry. So I'm going to, it's just two dinky Pop-Tarts. So I'm going to eat both of them. So I, beyond that recommendation, and I literally remember this because I was like postpartum. It was like the best run I had had in over a year. And so it's just that remembering too, like you, more carbs are better. That's just it.
I couldn't agree more. There's times like, for example, I found like my best runs are my best performances to that, like the recommendation 60 to 90 grams of carbs. And I think like I counted
per hour,
in hindsight.
Yeah,
per hour. Sorry. And when I was like, I had 100 grams of carbs per hour and I felt incredible.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And that's where I really think going back to how you said, we don't want to overanalyze the data too much because it can limit us. We have some, actually, I, in preparing for this conversation, where did I write it on my notes? There, I found somewhere a study, I think it was done on men. There were cyclists, but they actually increased their carb intake to 120 grams of carb per hour and found that they did tolerate it and that it did improve performance. Whereas like for a couple years now, we've been saying 90 grams of carbohydrate per hour. And it's like, I think we can really challenge carbohydrate intake and what this information is telling us is that there's a huge role of carbohydrates in performance, in energy metabolism, and making sure we're not getting into reds, in immunity, in bone health, in menstrual function. Like, there's just in vitamin and mineral absorption, we really need to challenge what we think is enough carbohydrate and give yourself permission to challenge that and have a little more, have a little extra, because the quote, air quote, extra might actually just be exactly right for you. It might not be extra at all. Does that make sense?
Yes. At no point have you ever, like, I know I have never gotten to a point of a run where I'm like 75% done with the run or whatever and been like, wow, you know what I wish? I wish I would have ate less carbohydrates. Normally I'm like, oh my goodness, why didn't you like pair another applesauce or whatever with it? And yeah, I've never been at a run and been like, wow, you know, if only I would have not had as many bites of carbohydrates.
Yeah. Now I have felt that way with fats, protein. I'll be honest. Like I have another very notable memory of like having this like coconut milk based soup and then trying to go for, and I love coconut milk and I love the fats in there, but like way too many fats before a run and like couldn't do it. But like, I agree. I don't think I've ever been on a run where I was like, that was too many carbs.
Exactly. I know. It's so funny how we know these things. And then like, I always like to, not always, but there's times where, you know, you're just not set up perfectly for a run, but you still do it. Yeah. And then like, you're like, oh my gosh, I know this. But you know, every now and then I find that I have to learn the hard way too with those things.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Trial and error is for everybody, even dietitians. So I think because of this importance on carbohydrate, again, going back to like general health and wellness, or what society perceives as healthy, this is where there's such a dichotomy, I suppose, of like, we're over here saying, have more carbs help performance, but like society is still very anti-carb and very nervous of carbs. From a health perspective, society is very concerned about maybe things like type 2 diabetes or insulin resistance or metabolic syndrome that might result, or society and health and wellness programs have told us to, you know, watch our carbohydrates, don't eat sugar, refined carbohydrates, because that might increase our risk of those conditions. And we're over here definitely focusing on sport and performance and health and getting out of reds and saying, no, you need more carbs. But it just creates this, it's just this like tension between the two of which one is right. And I don't want to neglect an athlete who is also concerned about health. Like that's part of being a good athlete. It's taking care of your health as well. But I really do feel like these are two different camps. I don't know. It's tough though, because then we can also have somebody who picks up exercise and sport maybe because of things that they're dealing with in health. So you could have somebody struggling with insulin resistance who then gets into marathon running. And you're balancing the two. It gets tricky and everything. But I think just because of that, there's been a lot of interest in looking at our blood biomarkers, looking at blood glucose levels, being interested in how, what, and how many carbohydrates we eat affect our blood glucose. And I know this is something that you've been diving into and even exploring a little bit personally as well. So I thought we could shift our conversation now to just talking about how carbohydrates affect our blood glucose level. And I want to start by just sharing, again, the athletic perspective. When we eat carbohydrates, we do have insulin released to help us take those carbohydrates from our bloodstream and into our muscles to use. And then this is where, again, society gets concerned about too much insulin release. However, when you are very active, you eat carbohydrates, and if you are regularly exercising, it doesn't have to be marathoning, it can be a 15-minute walk, any movement actually reduces the body's need for insulin, because at the muscle site, you release these transporters that exercise triggers on its own to help that blood glucose get into the muscle. GLUT4 transporters? Am I correct? Mm-hmm. Okay, good. GLUT4 transporters. So if you are an active person, you don't have as strong of an insulin response. And that's one thing that I always talk to my clients about that are concerned. If I'm eating too many carbs, I'm going to have too much insulin. I'm going to have too much inflammation. Well, actually, because you're active, you don't have as much of an insulin response. And that might be protective in some of those things we're talking about of insulin resistance or metabolic syndrome. The fact that you are an athlete, that you are exercising alone is helpful in that regard. And again, you need those carbohydrates, and just knowing that your body, because you're active, metabolizes them differently and uses them differently. What are some other ways that blood glucose, just things that affect blood glucose outside of just purely carbohydrate or sugar intake alone?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought this up, because I will die on this hill, even for just the healthy population, that carbohydrates are not the only thing that impact blood glucose. It is not, you know, it's not independent of variables like fiber. And guess what fiber is found in? A lot of carbohydrates. Yeah, exactly. Protein, fats, we know can impact what happens when we eat carbohydrates. So it's not just carbohydrates alone. So even looking through the lens of like medical community health and wellness, I think that sometimes physicians forget when they're giving diet instructions to their patients that your whole composition of your meal or whatever you're eating with carbohydrate matters. And so I think that applying that to athletes, you know, with thinking about blood sugar, that rule still applies. And then also when we onset exercise, as you already highlighted, like hormones are shifting at the onset of exercise because our bodies are incredible and it knows exactly what to do to get us to survive in that moment. So insulin is being downregulated, and other hormones like glucagon, which ultimately helps to increase our blood sugar, is being increased. So when we start exercise, we have like kind of some currency to play with in form of blood glucose.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, and I think remembering too, yeah, we need to eat more carbohydrates and lots of carbohydrates, but you're eating other things alongside with that, fiber, fats, proteins, which can reduce that like spike in blood sugar. I have not looked at true research on this, so this is something I've, quote, learned from social media. So I would love to hear your impact on it if you know, but I've actually seen some things saying like the order of which you eat things can impact your blood sugar. Have you ever seen or heard or read about this? Like, for example, like, eating your vegetables first, then your proteins and fats, and then your carbohydrate can lower a blood sugar spike. Do you know that?
I have not heard that.
Okay. I didn't either.
I haven't seen any specific research, but
we'll be cautious.
You and I
with
have
that.
Homework, I guess.
We have homework. It makes sense. It makes sense. And like, I wouldn't get too crazy about like, your, like enjoy your food, because it's a matter of minutes when you're eating a meal. So I don't see it making that big of a difference, but I've been seeing that online and I've been thinking, is this real? I need to research that. So we have a little homework to do. If somebody listening to this is really struggling with managing their blood sugar, it doesn't hurt to try and see if that helps, but it's a matter of minutes that all that food is in your stomach at the same time anyways.
Yes. And a lot of times, like, I'm even encouraging people to like slow down when they're eating anyway. And so that's like another step of like slow down plus like eat your vegetables and eat a specific order of food.
Yeah. Yeah. Even just that slowing down process is important. You know, if a meal takes you 5 minutes to eat versus 30 minutes to eat, we might have a different response. And again, bringing this back to the athlete perspective, there are times when you want a blood sugar spike.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know we're going to get into different kinds of glucose monitors and our experiences with it. But there was like one morning that it was my very first morning. Spoiler alert, I was wearing a form of a tool that helps to indicate what blood sugar might be suggestive of. And, you know, like I said, sometimes we're not set up for a run. I'm in my off season. I'm not super strategic. I went and had coffee with a friend. We had coffee longer than what we thought we were going to have. And then it was beautiful out. And I happened to be at the side of town that was the beach where I grew up. So I went on a run.
Yeah.
And this glucose meter, like, or not glucose meter, but CGM was like, my blood glucose was like 100, which is like, to me, a little bit on a low side to start a run. And I started running and went to like 120. I'm like, perfect. Just because of that response. So like kind of telling us by science, Lindsay, like what we already know of that like little like buffer, little bump. And I'm like, cool. Like we want that little bump.
We do. Yeah. And I thank you for sharing those numbers too. Because again, when you get your blood work done and you get your fasting blood glucose, doctors, I think they might flag anything above 100 as being elevated and high. Now that's a fasting number and it's a singular point in time. And Kelsey just gave you a real-time example of taking her blood sugar before a run was 100 and during a run 120, and that was desirable. So I've had lots of athletes coming to me getting their blood sugar drawn and they're getting nervous because, oh, I was 110, I was 100. And I'm like, this is okay. Like, once we start having fasting blood sugar that's like consistently, I don't know, like 150 or something, like on repeated tests, then we can start to be concerned. But there's this range of, you know, there's a reason when something is, oh, this is concerning, we actually started above 126 on a fasting level. But just because you're 120 or 115, you're actually not at that range of concern yet. And so let's not get concerned, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because like my thought process was, is I hope to be out here for an hour. And like over the course of the run, it like slowly trended down.
Yeah.
But like, if it didn't give me that buffer, then I would have maybe gotten into more hypoglycemic ranges. And so, yeah, I think normal, like, and I've seen like different numbers, so curious to see what your thoughts are, but like 70 to 150, which is like,
yeah,
for me, like that range is like kind of suggestive of like, hey, it's supposed to fluctuate throughout the day.
100% agree. Yes, it is. And do not, I think what I want to stress to my listeners is do not think that lower is better. You know, if the range is 70 to 150, don't think, and your blood sugar is 90, don't think, oh my gosh, I should lower it down to 70. I don't believe that to be true. It is fluctuating with your activity, with your hormones, with your stress levels. Give it a range to fluctuate. And there's so many reasons, even just thinking, going back again to a fasting morning blood sugar, how is your sleep that night? That's going to affect your blood sugar.
Are you stressed?
Are you stressed? Like, are you a morning exerciser? Maybe you don't want fasting blood sugar and you should eat before you go run, but that's a whole nother issue that we know people have as well. But like, you know, maybe we don't want to start that low. So yeah, I believe you want to give yourself that range. Let's backtrack for a moment here and just give some terminology for our listeners. So when blood glucose, when you go into a doctor's office for blood work, they draw blood from a vein and they get blood sugar from your plasma. And then we have, and that's, again, we have sugar in our muscles. We have sugar in our livers. We have sugar in our blood. The main purpose of sugar in your blood is to provide sugar to your brain. But when you are exercising and your muscles start to burn through their sugar, they start pulling from the blood. And that's where then your liver starts spitting out more sugar to provide to your blood so that your brain doesn't crash. That's the simplest way I can explain it, right?
Yes.
Okay. And then so a medical perspective, one of the most known blood sugar conditions where it's not working right is diabetes. There's type 1 diabetes, there's type 2 diabetes, there's also insidious diabetes, but the most common known are type 1 and type 2. And they do function differently, but I'm just going to speak broadly right now, it is very important for diabetics to monitor their blood sugar. They actually have high blood sugar. Their body can't produce insulin to help lower it. So they have high blood sugar and they very often have to take medicine to reduce their blood sugar, which can also be dangerous because if your blood sugar is too low and you don't get sugar to your brain, we can have hypoglycemic episodes, which can be life-threatening. And so even though diabetics have high blood sugar, there's a big risk with the medication or with exercise or even just diet mismanagement, there's a big risk of low blood sugar. And then Kelsey is talking about a continuous glucose monitor, a CGM. These are devices that people can implant essentially through their skin. It doesn't quite reach your blood. It doesn't reach your plasma. It actually, there's a little needle. You insert it, you stick it on your body. They can last anywhere between 5 to 14 days typically. And it measures your blood sugar in interstitial fluid, which is slightly different than blood glucose. As the technology has developed over the years, the actual device itself has a sort of algorithm to get it as close to what a blood glucose would be as possible. I know older versions, I know this because of my son and what he's going through, which I'll get to in a moment, but older versions of continuous glucose monitors were just off, just kind of two different numbers. They're measuring two different things. Current versions are, they're using algorithms within the device to match up so that what it's measuring of interstitial fluid, it's trying to match it up to what the hypothesized blood glucose would be. I will just tell you, because I use both on my son, he has a continuous glucose monitor, and I still use a meter as well. I poke his heel, poke his finger. And I mean, it is very common to be 10 to 15 points off from each other, and that's still considered a normal range. I actually did it on him this morning. His meter was saying that his blood sugar was at 95 and the heel stick blood glucose was actually 81. That was a 14-point difference, which to me is not big enough to actually calibrate. You can't calibrate these things. And I've got many stories of it being 40, 50 points off, and I have to calibrate it and try and get it more accurate. But in my perspective, and maybe yours too, to me, that is a big difference. 95 to 81 is a big difference. But according to how these devices work and their algorithms, it's considered within range of normal. So I just wanted to give that background to our listeners of what these devices are. And so what was your... So these devices, again, were originally developed for medical, like diabetes and management of that. But in recent years, we're seeing it break out into the use in the athletic population. And you have experience with that and trying that out. So can you share with us your reasons for wanting to try it and maybe some of your insights of trying it from an athletic perspective?
Yes, such an important distinction. And I think even I was going over some notes in like one of old sports, not old, but like circa 2018 sports nutrition book, which so not that old actually.
No.
Yeah, not that old. And even in the chapter about working with athletes that have type 1, they say don't dose insulin off of CGM readings.
Yeah.
And you can't do that. And there is a difference. And maybe they wouldn't say that now. There might be more research, but they even said with CGMs that they're straight up not as accurate as a glucometer. Mm-hmm. Now, it might be different now, and there's a lag time between interstitial fluid and your blood plasma. So a little bit different, and I think that that's kind of that world between clinical and performance to kind of think about. So, okay, so this is really cool. I'm in a research project for Nike, and they have unlimited resources. And so they asked if I wanted a CGM. My first initial gut feeling before the Olympic trials was no, because again, TMI. But then after, I was like, you know what? So many of my clients ask me, and with so many things, I feel like my brain doesn't comprehend until I get my hands and my experiences in it.
Yeah.
So like reading about something for me is way different than going and using it and doing it and being able to speak to it. And so that's kind of what made me like, I'm in this great like off season section of my training. And then I would, to your point, think that the science of it is cool and be able to speak to it a little bit better. And so my experience so far, mind you, I'm not training at 100%, but I'm probably doing 70-75% of normal training within the last like couple weeks. Mine's a 14-day of wearing the CGM. And I think that it validates a lot of what we understand, to be honest.
Mm.
I think one of the things that like, I think that like, on days that I'm really prepared for running and like I'm super on top of things, like I think that it's expected results. The only thing that's kind of been a little bit eye-opening for me is that I, based off the CGM data, on mornings that I was just grabbing like a quick carbohydrate, what I noticed is I had a little bit of what looked like not even like true reactive hypoglycemia, but my blood sugar go up and then drop into like the low 80s before exercise. And so I wondered if like, sometimes I feel like I take a long time to warm up. And I wondered if those two variables was connected. So I've been in the mornings, like adding milk to like, instead of having coffee, having a latte with milk with protein before I run, and just adding like either a fat or a protein to it. Which
in
is,
addition again, to your carbohydrate, right?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep. So pairing, using macronutrient pairing, which is, again, things that we already know.
We already know, right? But to see it is cool, because I actually have experienced that, not personally, in my clients, that they don't want to eat much in the morning. So we focus on just the carbohydrate.
Yes.
But then I do think that they experience symptoms of reactive hypoglycemia. Okay, we got our carbs in and now I'm crashing 20, 30 minutes later, right when I'm trying to start my workout. That, and it's like, oh, because you do need more than just carbohydrate.
Right. Yeah. And so, it, you know, and my intention is to give myself at the level that I train at that time than just having 100 or 200 quick carb calories of carbs before I roll out the door. And so that's my intention anyway. And so it just validated for me of like, hey, you do better when you wake up and have like enough time to get in a few different types of macronutrients in addition to the carbs. But then like my experience of telling you about, I carried my phone with me to have like what, you know, the CGM said that my blood sugar was during my run. And it was so cool and validating because I started again at 100 and then it bumped to 120. And then for the rest of the hour, and so an hour is kind of that time frame, like right before we start recommending during run nutrition. And it just like slowly dropped to like 100 throughout the course of the run. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as I stopped, I like went to go get in a line to get a smoothie. And I think my suspicion, I don't know, who really knows, but my suspicion is that now like insulin is working differently. Is my blood sugar dropped pretty quick after that. And it was like time for a recovery snack, but also it's like post-exercise. We know that that's like the ideal window to rebuild glycogen storages too.
So when you stopped running, your insulin, sorry, your carb blood sugar dropped even faster and again, validated the need for a recovery as quickly as possible and a recovery that included carbohydrate. And a significant
correct.
Amount.
So like, it's just like, for us, it's just like, this is cool to see it in real time.
Yeah.
But it's also just strengthening my knowledge of some of the principles that I feel like you and I are both using with our clients.
And I think that's, as these CGMs were coming out for a healthy and or athletic population, that's kind of what I felt is I was like, is it providing us any new information that we don't already know? And I didn't think that it would, but I'm open to continuing to learn. I think we can still explore it and see more. But I think that's the whole thing is that if you are a, quote, healthy and athletic population, is your body is working right. So these aren't things that we need to monitor because it's gonna do it. It's your body's going to figure it out. And I think this goes back to body trust, which is if we don't trust our bodies, we can heighten our, you know, disordered behaviors with food, with exercise, with body. And that was my fear of using continuous glucose monitors in an athletic or healthy population is we're going to distrust our bodies and we're going to overanalyze, why am I at a blood sugar of 90? Should I really be 80? Or, oh my gosh, I bumped up to 150. Is that bad? When in reality, no, that's still all a totally normal response of your body and your body will adjust. And maybe you don't need to manipulate anything at all. I'm a little nervous of people manipulating too much, and especially with the background of working in a population that is, I'm saying me, all athletes across the board of sports are at high risk of disordered eating. And I am nervous of excessive tracking and thinking that because my blood sugar is X, maybe I need to manipulate Y. I'm nervous about that.
1000%. Like, even just looking through, like, to me, like, I'm an expert with, I consider on the spectrum of relationship with food, like a pretty positive relationship with food on that spectrum. And I still waited until I wasn't seriously training to be able to have the capacity to take in this information and think about like what it meant for me with a ton of context of education behind it.
You're highly knowledgeable.
Right. Yeah. So I could go through the experience of being like, look how cool the body is that it's doing its job. But I don't know if someone started a run and saw their blood sugar spike up, if they would have been able to put the pieces together like I did
And to see that as a good thing, would somebody else have been like, oh, maybe now I don't need my intra-run fuel?
Oh, yeah, totally. I didn't even think about that. 1000%.
Which is the exact opposite of what should happen. But oh my gosh, yeah, that's what 50% of my clients would think. Oh my gosh, my blood sugar is higher now. I don't need it. False. I think that's why I'm nervous. And let's see. Sorry, I pulled it up here. I told you I was doing my research for this conversation. This was a 2022 study. A review of other studies. The use of continuous glucose monitors in sport, possible applications and considerations. I read through the whole thing. I will tell you at the end of it, it still says like not much information on using this for athletes and in sport. And we really need a lot more. I'm open to study. I'm open to research. I'm open to studying, open to learning more. I would strongly hesitate on our everyday athlete in using it. If you're a high-level athlete like Kelsey, maybe you can explore it with the help of a dietitian.
Yes.
That's what I would strongly say, with the help of a dietitian.
Yes. And something that I think that I'm even like trying to wrap my head around is something to consider with CGMs is it's not necessarily portraying how much muscle glycogen you're starting with either.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a whole other moving part of like, there's the interstitial fluid, but then that's not necessarily helping. Obviously, like the whole idea is that, like, you know, your liver glycogen is breaking down. Mm-hmm. And so if you're starting with more glycogen storage, but it's not necessarily telling us what kind of muscle glycogen you're starting with.
Absolutely. And this is the whole thing when we talk about fuel usage and carb oxidation during exercise. We need to know what your starting muscle glycogen is. And we're not going to be able to do that without a muscle biopsy. And we're not doing that before our everyday run here. So, yeah. And so that's why, too, when we think about your example of you started your run at 100 and then your blood sugar actually increased because your body started working. I'm running. I need more blood sugar. I'm going to start breaking down my muscle glycogen, potentially my liver glycogen. It started doing what it needed to do. Again, going back to body trust. Trust that if you don't have a medical condition, trust that your body can do this. It can figure it out for you. I have a very different experience because my son does have a blood sugar issue. He is the almost different pathways, but almost the opposite of diabetes, where his body cannot break down his liver glycogen. He can't break down stored energy. So once his blood sugar starts to drop, it will keep dropping until it is non-existent. So it is a life-threatening disorder for him every day of his life. And it's within a couple hours. He can't fast for more than 2 hours. 2 hours is his max. So I feed him, and I typically have to feed him 60 to 90 minutes later, which is very difficult. Every 60 to 90 minutes of my life, I am monitoring his life. And within about 90 minutes later, so I'll just give you a range. And this is, again, this is an unhealthy, quote, unhealthy, because his metabolism works totally different. He's missing enzymes. It's totally different. But let's say I start feeding him. His blood sugar might be 95, and I start feeding him. Well, it takes about 30 minutes for that food that I fed him to digest and absorb into his bloodstream. That's something for us, even as everyday person, recognize it takes time for whatever food you ate to digest and absorb into your bloodstream. So for him, I might feed him when his blood sugar's in the 90s. Over the course of the next 30 minutes after I fed him, he will continue to drop. It varies on what he's doing. He might drop to the 60s. He might drop to the 50s. He might drop to the 40s, to the 30s. And then he digests that food and his blood sugar starts coming back up. I think it's been interesting as he eats and once he eats, his blood sugar rises similar to anybody else's body. So you kind of asked me, what is the normal range, 70 to 150 for blood sugar to fluctuate? And yeah, typically that's what I've seen is his postprandial or after eating, his blood sugar, it varies, especially based on how much he eats, because I'm force feeding him. So he's not very hungry ever, but it can go up to the 130s, 150s. I've absolutely seen him in the 180s after a normal feeding. That has happened, but I'm always like, ooh, that got high. It's more normal, I think, more common for him to be in like the 150s after eating. That could be one hour after eating. That's like a normal postprandial. And going back to diabetes, the concern of high blood sugar, the people with those conditions might find that after eating, their blood sugar might be in the 200s, 300s, 400s. Those are abnormal numbers. And then, yeah, once the blood, again, my son's condition, once he gets up to 150, it's about an hour later, then within 30 minutes, he starts dropping. And I try and catch him on the downslide. I'm like, I see him at 150, 10 minutes later, he's at 120, 10 minutes later, he's at 90. And I'm like, whoa, got to start feeding him now. And I start feeding. And so that's really interesting. Again, he's in body works totally different than ours. But as he's growing, he's only 9 months old. He just started crawling this weekend. I'm like, whoa, how is activity going to affect this? Physical activity, wake time, sleeping. I'll tell you the most crazy thing, Kelsey. He's on overnight, because I don't want to wake up every 60 to 90 minutes overnight.
My first question.
Yeah, he's got a G-tube. He's on a continuous overnight feed. He's constantly fed overnight at a slower drip rate. But the Dexcom is life-saving. I have that thing on super loud. You can hear it in any room of the house, because we do have leaks overnight. The tube could leak. He can pull it out. Various things can happen, and his blood sugar can tank, and it's crazy. But what I was going to say is sometimes that thing starts beeping at me at 2 a.m. and it's like beep, beep, beep. And I jump out of bed because I'm nervous of an accident, because we've had accidents happen before, and he doesn't have a leak. Everything's fine. He's being fed. As he's sleeping, laying down, doing nothing, his blood sugar fluctuates and he's being continuously fed the same rate all night long.
Right.
Did you interpret any, you're wearing it overnight. Did you see anything? Did you look at your overnight blood sugar? Because that was super insightful to me to see. He would be 130. Next thing you know, he's 80 overnight. I'm like, you're sleeping. You're not doing anything. And then he would I wouldn't change his feeding and he would increase back up to 100.
Yeah. So even his little body is like regulating in some capacity.
It is.
And he, yeah, yeah, yes, definitely. And dropping. So even, I know I want to get back to talking about him, but even like some of the rules about like not eating after 7 p.m., like I'm someone that like bedtime snack.
Yeah.
And so like, I'm always curious of like, I've seen my blood sugar drop like low overnight. And so I'm even someone, if I didn't have that bedtime snack, what would happen?
Yes. And again, I think going back to some of my clients, so many clients that are struggling with sleep, which I, in my field of clients I work with that might be struggling with reds or low carb availability,
right.
I'm like, you need that nighttime snack because I think that their blood sugar is probably dipping overnight and that's waking them up.
Yes. Yes. Totally.
They're like, oh, something's wrong. And they're waking up. They're not, or they're getting restless sleep. I think that could be happening. It's crazy to think that, yeah, your body overnight, you might see blood sugar dip. So I wouldn't worry about super high blood sugar overnight. I don't know if you have night terrors and you're stressed. I don't know what might happen. We'd have to be wearing the CGM for that. But I do think that nighttime snack for athletes or people struggling with sneak against society might say don't eat before bed. And you might be somebody that might sleep better, have better blood sugar control with a well-balanced nighttime snack.
Oh, yeah. And one of the questions, like I've been wearing this Whoop and have a lot of feedback about the nutrition component. And one of the questions that it like gives you points for is, did you eat all of your meals while the sun was out?
Oh, bad question.
That's such a weird question. That's such a weird question to me because those hours are going to change throughout the year if you...
No kidding. Whatever. Yeah, Whoop needs to do better on that one.
Yeah, come on. You heard it here first. But yeah, like, you know, in terms of blood sugar overnight and everything, like... I cannot imagine what my blood sugar would be overnight if the last time I ate was at my dinner time.
Yeah. Right.
As far as like measuring to like energy needs and, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. Right. Yeah. So interesting. Yeah. I think there's a lot more to explore in the use of continuous glucose monitor. I'm personally so grateful for them with this personal situation of my son. It is his lifesaver. But I am going to go back to again, and you mentioned this too. Even though the science of them is getting much more precise and it's just getting more, what's the word I want to use? Precise is a good word. The science of them is getting more precise. You know, we want to be careful with these devices and taking everything for as is. Because even in the case of my son, like I said, for him, like again, if he's blood sugar 70, that's within normal range. But if he's actually really 60 or 55 and how his body works, like that's not good for him. And so we have to be careful using these devices. And we still have to, I think, look at symptoms, how you're feeling, trust in your body.
Yeah.
That's hard for my baby because he's only 9 months, so he can't tell me. But there are times actually that he's acting weird.
Yeah.
He's acting weird. It can, for him, it's fussy, it's uncomfortable, it's needing me, like looking for me, and then he absolutely gets sweaty. And sometimes I'm like, but what's wrong? And his blood sugar might be showing it's fine, but like 10 minutes later, it's not. And I've recognized, I think he can feel the drop.
Yeah.
What every once in a while, he has a really rapid drop. And I think he can feel that. And I think that we, you and I and other people in who don't have conditions like my son, I think we feel that drop too. I think that's when we get hangry, we get shaky.
Right. And so like kind of going off of like digging into these cues and everything, I think that those cues are there for a reason, just, you know, out of evolution. And so, again, like I think that some of these cues and things that we already knew about symptoms of hunger are like telling us what the CGM is. It's not giving us new information. To your point, I have to ask this question. So obviously there's not a lot of overlaps. I know that like your son's situation is very different from like a normal healthy human, but like would you say that going through this experience like with CGMs, like anything that you can think of that like now how you think about blood sugar and everything or CGMs, has it changed of working with your clients?
Oh, good question. No
because it's not comparable.
Well, I think one thing, it's given me more confidence.
Yeah.
It's given me a lot more confidence that when somebody gives me their blood work, I feel a lot more comfortable with looking at the numbers and understanding it. Because now I've known how the body is supposed to work. And now I have firsthand experience of what is not right.
Yeah.
So when a client comes to me getting nervous, oh, my HbA1c is this and my fasting blood sugar is this and I felt like this, I feel a lot more comfortable. And I've also worked with diabetic patients in the past too. So I have, but the firsthand, the day in, day out experience with my son has showed me what is abnormal, what is not correct. So I feel a lot more comfortable 90% of the time telling my clients, you are okay. Like, this is within normal. Your body's reacting right. I don't know if I've had a client that I've been alerted. But aside from the reactive hypoglycemia experiences mm-hmm. in clients, I'm like, that's come up quite a bit. But I think that's the biggest change with my hands-on experience now is I have a lot more confidence talking about blood sugar. Also, the use of CGMs, like just the application of it. And I'm sure that was helpful for you too. What does it feel like? Where do you put it on your body? He's using it regularly, so we're developing skin rashes, we're developing bruises from using it over and over and over again. I can see in sport, this isn't going to be ideal for every sport. His have fallen off and ripped off just by putting pants on and off of him. So it's like combat sports, you can't, it's not going to be easy to use CGMs. You can't do this while playing jujitsu, competing, you know, like you just like, you can't do, my husband does jujitsu and I'm like, yeah, Levi's probably not going to do jujitsu. That's, you know, it's just going to rip right off of him. And so I think I just have a lot more hands-on experience and what works, what doesn't, what normal versus abnormal is. But my recommendations haven't changed too much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll keep learning. I'm 9 months into this and, you know, I'll keep learning as I go, as I think you will as well with your perspectives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Definitely.
Kelsey, I could keep talking to you for hours, but I'm going to respect your time. We're already over. I'm so sorry. But thank you. This was awesome. And I've been wanting to talk about this because of my personal experience, but I didn't really have the confidence yet. And so I love getting to do it with you as another sports dietitian and then having that personal experience too. I think it was just such a good conversation. I hope our listeners enjoyed it as much as I did.
I did too. Thank you so much for having me. And I love that you tied in healthy metabolism with what your experiences of what you're going through. And I think that it just gives a lot of perspective.
For sure. Oh, our fun questions. Oh, Kelsey, if there's one food you could eat every single day for the rest of your life and never be sick of it, what would it be?
Ooh, an underbaked chocolate chip cookie.
Underbaked. Yes, totally. I mean, sometimes they make the cookie dough now that you can just eat raw because they're like, so many people like it raw better. But I love that. Just slightly underbaked. Seems obvious, but it might not be. What's your favorite sport to participate in?
Running.
Yeah. And how about as a spectator? What's your favorite sport to cheer on?
Basketball. I think it's just very quick paced. And I love like the small teams and you get to like kind of know the players because the team is so small.
Yeah. I went to a basketball game. 2 nights ago, we have the Spurs here in San Antonio. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was fun. It is fast paced. It's nice, especially with children. I was like, I need this game to be quick. So it was good.
Yeah.
Okay. And then if there's a female athlete out there in your personal life or well-known that you want to give a shout out to for any reason, who would it be and why?
Oof, so many of them. I will give a shout out to one of my best friends, training partners. Her name's Lydia McCray. She is someone that picked up running later. She wasn't an athlete growing up, but I've seen her over the last decade just really implement every resource she could get her hands on, including nutrition. And now she coaches. And so relay that to her other athletes. And I feel like not only did I get to see her improve into her 40s, now like other female athletes are getting the benefit of her being nudging them on nutrition.
I love that. Well, thank you so much. And thank you for today and all your time. I appreciate it.
Yes. Thank you so much. Thank you for your time as well.
Well, everybody, thanks for listening. I really hope you enjoyed that episode. And if you did, if you are a true fan of female athlete nutrition, then I would love if you could support our podcast by spreading the word. Share a review on your listening channel. Give us 5 stars. It really helps get the word out and get the show more views to positively impact others. Also, you can support the podcast by joining our Patreon. Head to patreon.com/femaleathletenutrition to consider a donation, or even better, join our membership where you get extra monthly content and perks. we don't want you to simply listen alone. We want you to be a part of a community and a movement of fierce, fit, and fueled female athletes. So patreon.com/femaleathletenutrition is where you can do exactly that, learn more, and join. A huge thanks to our affiliates and partners as well. Once again, Prevenix, Inside Tracker, Orgain, Practice Better, Jen and Carrie, please go check them out and their links in the show notes where you can get deals and discounts. Last, be sure that you do more than just listen. If you need help with fueling, it's time to take action. Head to my website to learn more. You can either book a free call with me to learn more about our coaching programs and how we can work directly with you, whether it's the fast track or otherwise. Or you can take our online self-study course, Female Athlete Nutrition. You can literally sign up and gain access right now. You can explore our downloadable products, including the Red S Recovery Guide, High Iron Fueling Guide. Or if you are a coach of a team, check out our brand new Coaches Toolkit for teams. You can also just learn more. We have a blog, a Red S quiz to see if Red S is affecting you. If you need help, I want you to get help fast. Too many girls and athletes struggle with nutrition, but you don't have to any longer. You can rise up with the power of nutrition, take action today in any of these avenues, and become fierce, fit, and fueled. Links in the show notes, and we'll see you next time.